Edward Waters College president Nat Glover says he's stepping down. The Jacksonville City Council gives themselves a pay raise and hires some new police. Meanwhile, Councilman Reggie Gaffney issues a high-profile apology. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our media roundtable. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, we're going to tell you about some local efforts to help people in Puerto Rico. Also, don't miss it as we welcome Kevin O'Connor, host of the long-running PBS hit This Old House. He's in town this weekend at the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday, time to discuss a busy news week as we welcome Mark Woods of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Charles Griggs is here with the Florida Star.
Jacksonville Free Press.
Free Press. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's been a long week. Sorry, Charles. And I really shouldn't have screwed that up because I need to also note that you have just joined our WJCT Board of Directors.
Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the studio, Mr. Board, not chairman, but member. And WJCT's own Lindsay Kilbride here.
Hello, Melissa.
Good to have you here. Lots to discuss this week. Everything from more money in the local budget for hiring more police to a standoff between police and a city councilman and more. But our top story, in a surprise move, Dr. Nat Glover announced Thursday night he will step down as president of Edward Waters College. He's an alumni of that school as well. Glover says with the city council this week approving an $8.5 million revitalization plan for the EWC campus, this is a good time for him to step aside and retire. Glover was the first African-American elected sheriff in the state of Florida since Reconstruction. And there's so much to discuss here. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at Nat Glover's legacy here in Jacksonville. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on Facebook. And Charles, let's begin with you. In a statement Dr. Glover sent here to WJCT, he said, "Retirement is a strong word, but I am looking forward to the transition at the college and will remain engaged, and I still have work to do."
I can tell you that President Glover is probably one of the youngest 74-year-olds that I know. And, you know, he can be credited with bringing stability to Edward Waters College at a time when the school was consistent with being unstable. And I think, like he mentioned in the article, the funding that they recently received from the city is paramount for their success. This sort of puts them on track to compete with other schools in the area, and his legacy will note that. And so this is a bittersweet time.
Yeah.
I think it's the right time for him to move forward if
and,
he likes.
And so he goes off now into a new stage of life, securing millions for Edward Waters College, which was a big win. And, of course, the legacy he has in this community is much larger than just what he's done at EWC. Mark Woods, Nat Glover, became the first African-American sheriff in this state since the Reconstruction era. It was a path-breaking election for Jacksonville and Florida when he was made sheriff.
Right, and I'd say, you know, he retires or whatever his retirement is, as, you know, one of the most widely respected people in this town from, you know, all corners of the town. You know, he's a fascinating figure, you know, going back to Axe Handle Saturday, being a part of that. And there's a great story he tells about that when he went to school at Edward Waters and he wanted to play football, and the coach told him, "You have to keep your grades up and do this, and you have to clean this restroom here." And that restroom is now across the hall from where
he sits as president. So coming full circle.
So he talks about that. I think he's someone who, great success, but, you know, that's kind of the symbolic, never forgot where he came from kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yes, he's a great figure in our community, and hopefully we'll remain quite involved.
It's 549-2937. Lindsay Kilbride.
Yeah, and he's so embedded in the community. Obviously, he's served a number of roles, been on boards. He was on the vote for the police and fire pension, you know, with Brown and before Curry's plan and everything. So, I mean, he's a prominent person in Jacksonville. So, you know, as he said, retirement's a strong word. I assume he'll be around.
Sure. Someone just tweeted the show. Grammar Police, Nat Glover is an alumnus of EWC. Alumni is plural. Thank you for that. You know, Charles, Mark just mentioned this famous story that Nat Glover always used to tell. In 1964, he was working as a busboy or a cafeteria worker at the old Morrison's cafeteria that faced onto Hemming Plaza. It is now the site of the Dalton Agency. I used to work there, and I had heard that it used to be a cafeteria long before I moved here. It was segregated, of course. Mm-hmm. You black folks would say you could work there, but you couldn't eat there.
That's right.
Nat Glover could work there, but he couldn't dine there. And the story goes that he walked out of his shift at Morrison's onto the Hemming Park Plaza to see Axe Handle Saturday going on. This is 1964, the height of the civil rights movement. There were white guys all over the park beating young black folks with axe handles and sticks because they were trying to integrate lunch counters in downtown Jacksonville. And so he walked right into that and could have been hurt or killed and managed to get away.
Absolutely. And just think about all of the people who are Nat Glover-like, who went through many of these circumstances. And as he ran for sheriff, a lot of that came out because he was a guy who came through the ranks and, proved himself along the way, holding up those standards that embodied, being someone who can be respected in the community. And he's a great mentor to many people. And I know that he's part of his passion is leadership development. So he'll be, as he rides off into the sunset, looking to do more of that and share his information that he can help round some other folks in the community as well.
I had the opportunity to go to a leadership seminar Nat Glover led several years ago. This is before he was appointed president of EWC, and he had a lot to say in this seminar, but the main thing I remember him saying was he learned the hard way coming up through the ranks at the sheriff's department that, as he put it, someone's always watching.
That's right.
If you are an employee of a company, no matter what your position is, you are representing that company everywhere you go. So if you are at Publix at 11 o'clock at night picking up a bottle of milk, someone is watching you, and you have to behave at all times as an ambassador of that company because you just never know when someone might be watching your behavior at a moment when you think you're not being observed. You're always being observed. You're always an ambassador for your company. And so that really stuck with me. That was a good piece of advice.
So when you're shopping at Publix now.
Yeah, I mean, you just never know when someone's going to roll up to you and say, oh, I want to talk to you about something at your station. You know, it's true.
True. Yeah.
And so, but going beyond that, when we talk about Nat Glover's legacy with the JSO, let's talk about that for a minute, because many people listening may not remember that election or those times in this city and what it meant for his election to be successful and the types of initiatives he held as sheriff, that he led as sheriff.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people remember most about his campaign and his tenure was the fact that he was walking in communities. And I recall during his campaign, the commercial was started, I walked the streets, and he's talked to people in the community. And that was something that was almost new around that era. And then when he came in, he had the police officers put their names on the vehicles. And that was sort of new, too. And that was a level of accountability where you could improve community policing around, that tactic and strategy. So, some of the things that he did were very, revolutionary. And he had to unite the police force, too, because there were the other candidates that were running at the time. It was on the edge of being divisive. But he did a good job of bringing all sides together and being able to work within the community.
And then you think of that ran for mayor,
yeah.
and you know, what was that, 2003,
yeah,
I believe?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And of course, John Payton elected mayor, but yes, he did run in that race.
You know, and a strong candidate that, you know, was pretty close. It was a pretty close race, so almost made history there, too.
Yeah, you can't take lightly his, because of the mayor's race, his ushering into political arena, how the resources he's developed, which have benefited Edward Waters College and in the entire community, but specifically Edward Waters College in this day and time. I don't think they would have been able to pull off the type of funding that they just received had it not been for his ability to work with the powers that be within the community.
If you're just tuning in, it's our media roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. And as Charles mentioned, the city council awarding millions to revitalize Edward Waters College and the surrounding neighborhood this week. They also authorized 100 new police officers to be added to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. A beefed up police force definitely has all along been one of Mayor Lenny Curry's biggest priorities in this $1.27 billion budget, which passed unanimously Tuesday night. They're also funding 42 new firefighters and a $50 million Safer Neighborhoods plan, and that includes the investment in Edward Waters College. What do you think about this, folks? What do you think about 100 new police officers for Jacksonville? It's 549-2937 to join us. And this is something that Mayor Curry campaigned on, public safety. And so this can certainly be seen as a win for his administration.
Yeah, this is what he's been saying all along, is that he wanted to bring the force back up to levels it was, I think, 2007-2009 era. He had a little bit of pushback, definitely. A lot of the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition members early on during council meetings and finance meetings would come forward saying, first, we need a better police accountability and then maybe more officers. But, you know, that should come first. However, on council night, there weren't many commenters on the budget at all, honestly, but not on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And here's a few other items in the budget. They're going to allocate $8 million to demolish the old courthouse and city hall, annex a downtown on the river to prepare for future development, more money for road resurfacing, sidewalks, senior centers, parks, libraries. I don't believe the libraries got all they wanted, but they did get something.
Yeah, I think it was $850,000.
Right. Yeah. About half of what they asked for.
They wanted money to...
They wanted $2 million, I think.
To extend hours.
And the council voted to increase their own salaries, by the way.
Yes.
To get them back up to the previous levels. And you know, that's fair.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. This marks the first time that the council really had some money to play with, you know, because of pension reform. And so the first thing to do was to keep those promises about, you know, around public safety and invest some things back into the community. And so people want to be able to see and be able to touch and feel what they've sort of voted for. And this is what the mayor promised. It looks like everybody was getting a little bit of what they wanted, and that's probably why you didn't hear much of a discussion outside of Councilman Becton, who wanted to divert the money.
City Councilman Danny Becton was opposed to the money for EWC.
Right. His argument, I think, was that the extending water lines and improving drainage, and that there were priorities on the north side that were more pressing than... You know, I can see his argument. Yeah. I mean,
he really didn't see how this would benefit the community as a whole as much as maybe water projects and whatnot. That was his argument. He also had a couple other amendments dealing with pension funding. So he wanted to have an extra pension payment because, you know, his whole argument this whole time has been, you know, he really feels like the pension plan is kicking the can down the road. So that's been his argument. But his council members on all three of his amendments did not even give him a second, meaning there was no discussion about them. However, during finance committee meetings, there was discussion, especially about the Edward Waters portion, you know, where they did have a little bit of back and forth, and no one really really backed him up on diverting the money away from Edward Waters. And a lot of it, too, is that was Mayor Curry's, one of his big priorities, held a big press conference from it. So really going against it is also going against the administration. Yeah. So, you know, it's a bigger thing and than just the funding.
Clearly, Curry wanted that. But doesn't it also speak to the political skills of Nat Glover?
It does, because, you know, he's been... This was an opportunity for people to take part in what was considered to be a large larger campaign for pension reform. And the fact that Edward Waters College was able to get a piece of some of the rewards from that pension reform speaks to his ability to work with through the politics on it.
Let's go to your calls. What are your thoughts on all of the headlines of the week? 100 new police officers for Jacksonville included in the new budget and more. 549-2937. Mark is in Mandarin. Hey, Mark, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I'm just chewing.
having breakfast while you listen to us? Cool.
Right, definitely, of course. you mentioned several times that that Nat Glover was elected sheriff. I think an even bigger achievement was he was reelected, because I remember when I moved to Jacksonville, he already was sheriff, and I remember voting for him for reelection. I think that's a bigger achievement because it shows that he's already been serving the job and people were happy with his performance.
That's a good point. Yeah, thank you for that, Mark.
Yeah,
very popular sheriff.
Very popular. And I remember that it was right when Nat Glover was leaving the sheriff's office, if I recall, he had put more than 40 students through college himself with his own foundation money. I mean, that's an amazing accomplishment. That's something that you don't see often. I think he was probably, he had set it up and then he was doing it. That's one of the things that's a give back to the community that can't be taken lightly.
All right. And also making news this week, this was quite a dust up between a city councilman and the local Fraternal Order of Police. This week, Jacksonville City Council member Reggie Gaffney apologized to the entire city, his colleagues, his Northside constituents, and the JSO for his behavior during a traffic stop incident first reported by our partner, News for Jax. FOP President Steve Zona asked Gaffney and Council Member Katrina Brown, who was involved in the incident, to either apologize to the police or resign. He accepted Gaffney's apology Tuesday. This happened during a traffic stop when Gaffney was pulled over for driving with a license plate he had reported stolen. Video of the incident showed Gaffney and the police interacting. And as we discuss this, we want your calls at 549-2937. So this sort of resolved itself with the councilman apologizing, which the FOP had demanded. And FOP President Steve Zona appeared on this program the other day saying much the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's never good when a public figure do you know who I am kind of moment.
Apparently that's what happened. Yeah. Gaffney told the police officer, do you know who I am, when he was pulled over, something like that.
And then it's still, you know, questionable that he reported his license plate stolen a year ago after repeated red light camera stops. And then that license plate is back on his car. So I don't know if, a thief just borrowed it and returned it to the car. That'd be kind of an only in Florida moment right there.
Save that one.
And Councilwoman Katrina Brown pulled up during the incident. So that's how she became involved. She said publicly she has felt intimidated by the FOP and felt that she had been attacked for questioning the sheriff's office about Mayor Curry's request for 100 new police officers.
Yeah, it sounds like that she felt like she was justified in not apologizing because of the tone of the messaging that had come from the FOP leader. And it would seem like that she would want for the some type of investigation to take place around how some of that information was released. And that's what I heard Tuesday night. It almost warrants a little more. I mean, the message from her recollection bordered on unprofessional to her as a sitting council member, and almost threatening. Mm-hmm. So that was her rationale for not apologizing, because she felt like that sent a message, enough of a message, the message that she would be concerned about her interactions with police officers.
And at a separate press conference on Wednesday, Sheriff Mike Williams had a brief press conference with media about the 100 officers. Obviously, the situation came up. And prior to Wednesday, JSO had had no comment on the situation, but he did stop short of saying they were, you know, investigating Gaffney, which is, he was saying, we're going to look deeper into what happened and see if we can clear all this up. So don't know exactly what that means, but it seems like now the situation is on JSO's radar as to, you know, how did he get this license plate back? That's kind of the question nobody really knows right now, which is why was it reported stolen and now back on his car?
It's 549-2937. Jimmy on the South Side. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
Hi. I guess my issue is, like, whenever there's an issue with police, they're beyond reproach. I mean, you can't question anything they do. But my question then is, what initiated the stop? I mean, like, why was the plate run in the first place? Was it run because he made an illegal turn, he ran a stoplight, or something of that nature? Because other than just randomly running plates, which, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be, wouldn't that be like a civil liberties violation to just randomly run U.S. citizens' plates and, you know, find something? And then, two, wouldn't that lend itself to profiling? Because why would it be that guy's plate that was run?
Yeah. Thanks for that, Jimmy. You know, the other day, FOP Chief Steve Zona appeared on this program, and I asked him that question. Why were you running this plate to begin with? And was this an incident of racial profiling, since police could observe it was an African-American man driving the vehicle? And Zona said, we run dozens of plates every day. We do this all the time. It's routine. There was no particular reason why this plate was run. And that wasn't really a complete answer as to why that plate was being run. But that was the FOP's answer to that question, and a lot of callers asked him the same question.
So perhaps maybe the sheriff should define the policy behind why and how plates are run randomly, if that's the case. And then maybe that'll clear up some of the argument around why there was a stop in the first place. And, you know, go ahead, Mark.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, I'm poking fun at how the plate reported stolen mysteriously appears. But yeah. I think there are legitimate questions about how this plays out. I think, you know, I'm having some fun with that, but I think Katrina Brown probably raises some legitimate questions too. So there's a lot of things.
Yeah, this is a complicated story.
Right.
Yeah. Sure.
And there was also some questions around, you know, how the information became available so soon when there was supposed to be an investigation taking place. So a few questions that need to be answered that haven't been answered so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her main feedback was, we really should be focusing on how this tape was leaked out. Sheriff Williams responded saying, you know, it is public record. However, we maybe should look at the policy as to what happened in this situation.
Yeah. But as you noted, Lindsay, it is public record. Anyone that wants to go look at the details can. And finally, it's our look at the strange, ridiculous, and just plain bizarre news from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do crocodiles go for a leisurely stroll down the street. This happened down in Cutler Bay. That's Miami-Dade County. Early Tuesday morning, police spotted the massive croc. He called for backup, blocked off the streets, summoned a gator trapper, but it was an endangered saltwater crocodile walking down the street, so they couldn't just capture it.
I'd say you'd be endangered.
After a couple of hours, the crocodile just walked off and swam into a nearby lake, thus resolving the problem. Now, this is a cool story. Only in Florida is a dog displaced by Hurricane Irma tearfully reunited with his owners.
Aww.
Miko, a 40-pound brindle dog evacuated from a Florida shelter at the height of the storm, was spotted the other day grieving and sad in a Tennessee shelter 700 miles away. As Irma approached, Florida shelters evacuated strays to make room for animals that they expected to need shelter. So Miko was one of seven dogs flown to a shelter in East Tennessee. Some East Tennesseans wanted to adopt him, but the rescuers decided he probably had someone in Florida who loved him and that they would try to find them. Oh. Through divine intervention, Miko's family was found in Plant City, Florida. Social media helped a lot, and we can happily report that today he is back home. Very nice to hear.
Aww.
I know.
There's also a nice dog story in today's Florida Times.
Yes, there is. And I'm so sorry, I was a little behind my deadline this morning, and I didn't have time to put another one in. So go to jacksonville.com to read that story. Thank you, Mark Woods, Charles Griggs, and Lindsay Kilbride. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thank you.
Back in a moment, but right now, here's how you can support First Coast Connect and all your favorite programs here on WJCT.
Give us a call right now at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. Every Friday, we bring you the Media Roundtable. It's always been very popular. We bring journalists from our own journalists and journalists from around town to talk about the major issues of the week, even things that break last night. It was last night when you learned that Nat Glover planned on resigning. So we were able to catch up and bring you that information in case you did not know that was happening. We bring you all that great news. We bring you great segments on First Coast Connect. So popular, I hear it all the time of people who say they just love listening to First Coast Connect. If that's you, if you want to make sure we're always here for you, then please make that call now, 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. We have been bringing you the coverage of storms, the important news that's going on throughout the week. This is important because we know it's important to you. We remember when we were here with Irma on the air for more than 2 days, bringing you the news that you needed to know about, and including the dangerous stuff, because remember we had the flash floods around the river, and those crept up very quickly. We had our own Jessica Palumbo, who had to be evacuated from her home. A lot of people also had to do. We had to make sure, here is how you can get yourself evacuated if you must. We brought you that information. All we ask is you two to do your part. So make that call now. Thank you very much. Once again, the number is 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, online wjct.org. And thank you very much from all of us here at your public radio station.
Join WJCT and Special Forces Association Chapter 88 for an evening watching, listening to, and discussing the many stories of service from the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War and Stories of Service is October 3rd at 7 p.m. at WJCT Studios. For more information and to RSVP for this free event, visit wjct.org/storiesofservice. WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Should I introduce you as president? Welcome back. Well, there are a number of benefits happening around the region this weekend to help Puerto Rico. The island is in truly dire straits right now, struggling for food, water, power in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Puerto Rico has 3.4 million U.S. citizens without power, food, or water on an island just 100 miles wide. So advocates are putting out the call here on the First Coast to come together and help our family in the Atlantic. One big event we want to tell you about right now. Come on out to the Jacksonville Landing this Sunday, October 1st, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and drop off hygiene products, food, clothing, whatever you think will be of use. This event is sponsored by the Puerto Rican and Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Again, come on out to the Landing this Sunday from 11 to 6. It's a benefit for Puerto Rico, and they need hygiene products, food, and clothing in particular. Now, with all of the attention on Puerto Rico right now, it's important to remember the struggles of millions of others in the Caribbean, like Haiti. still recovering from a devastating series of natural disasters. Not only that, this fall, the Department of Homeland Security is poised to send 59,000 Haitians who benefit from a program called Temporary Protected Status back to an island that has yet to recover from earthquakes and hurricanes, including Hurricane Matthew last year, and a deadly cholera outbreak as well. There is an expert on Haiti in town this week, and he's talking about this. We're pleased to welcome Steve Werlin, author of To Fool the Rain, Haiti's Poor and Their Pathway to a Better Life. Steve, good to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
And joining Steve, Alan Bliss, president of the Jacksonville Historical Society and adjunct professor of history at UNF. Good to see you too, Alan.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you.
And Jacksonville attorney Michael Fisher, who's involved with the Haitian advocacy group FONCASE. That's Haiti's largest microfinance organization.
Thank you very much for having us, Melissa.
Thanks, gentlemen, for being here. And FONCASE has just done incredible work in Haiti, and particularly with women in Haiti, and pulling them out of poverty. Steve Werlin, your book, To Fool the Rain, looks at this. And for people that aren't familiar with extreme poverty in Haiti, your book is a real eye-opener.
No, thank you. We wrote the book because the experience we had was so of the strength and the capacity of women to change their own lives, to pull themselves out of poverty once they have the tools that they need to go to work, was so impressive that it just seemed like a story that needed to be told.
And you can learn about this by reading To Fool the Rain, but also, Alan and Michael, there are some opportunities to meet Steve and hear more about this issue here in Jacksonville coming up, correct?
That's right. This afternoon at 1:30, Steve will be speaking on the campus of the University of North Florida in the Social Sciences Building 51, room 1205. There will be copies of his book, To Fool the Rain, available for signing. And Steve will be speaking to graduate students and undergrads and faculty and staff about his experience in Haiti. This is being co-sponsored by my department, the Department of History, as well as the Center for International Studies. Tomorrow morning, Steve will be at the Riverside Arts Market from 10 a.m. until noon, I believe, right? And there will be copies of his book available there, and Steve would welcome an opportunity to speak about his experience. And he will be appearing also at Riverside Presbyterian Church for a reception Saturday evening at 6:30, and that's open to the public as well, and books available there too.
Excellent. Michael Fisher, you've been long involved in Haiti, and so this is something close to your heart.
Yes, it's very important to distinguish this from emergency relief. This is sustainable relief, and people think what is good in happening in Haiti, and we can say that over a 20-year period, we have sustained families with over 72,000 loans to small entrepreneurs, over 200,000 savings accounts, and as Milton Friedman, many of you know, was a Nobel laureate, has famously said, the poor are not poor because they're lazy, but because they lack access to capital. That's what FONCASE is doing. They're allowing us to provide capital on a sustainable basis to people as well as other services. One thing that Alan didn't mention is if you'll come to the program Saturday night at Riverside Presbyterian at 6:30, you'll learn where you can be actually firsthand, go to Haiti with us and see how these programs are working to sustain people out of poverty.
And that's how microfinance works. Let's explain the model, because FONCASE has had a lot of success with this in Haiti. Can you explain a little bit about how microfinance operates, Steve?
Yeah, the idea behind microfinance is that traditional is access to capital and education is key. And so traditional lending models that depend on cosigners or collateral just aren't available to people who are poor. So rather than working with collateral, FONCASE, like many other microfinance institutions, has women take out loans together,
having them vouch for one another. So groups of five women take out a loan, take out five loans and repay them on the same schedule. But what's interesting is that when you start doing that, you find that even with small loans, $25, $50, there are families that are too poor to make use of that level of capital. Mm-hmm. And when we discovered that, we had to look for another solution. And that solution turned out to be what we now call the pathway to a better life, which rather than involving loans, involves grants, intense training, and close accompaniment over the course of 18 months to help someone get to the point where she actually could take advantage of loans if she chose to do so.
And this track record for this program is pretty good.
It's excellent. Around the world, it's been excellent. Fonds-Causé in Haiti is not the only institution using this approach. It's been tested widely worldwide, but our success rate to date has been about 96%. That means 96% of the women that join it need no further support after 18 months.
Fantastic. And, you know, right now there's certainly a lot of attention focused on the plight of Puerto Rico, but it's important to remember there are people hurting all over, especially in Haiti, which is still reeling from its own series of natural disasters.
So many interventions and attempts to help the people of Haiti have been animated by catastrophes and natural disasters, and so many of those efforts have been ephemeral and passing, and they have misfired. And one of the things that has impressed so many of us about Fonds-Causé is that it is ongoing and sustainable, and it outlasts the passing moments of catastrophe, but that is lamentably something that the people of Haiti are all too familiar with.
Right. So three opportunities to learn more about this weekend. 1 o'clock today at UNF. Come on out to the Riverside Arts Market Saturday to meet Steve and get a copy of his book. And then Saturday evening, mark your calendar for a reception at 6:30 p.m. at Riverside Presbyterian Church. And again on Sunday, 9:30 a.m., it's Steve Worland's To Fool the Rain book tour, Haiti's Poor and Their Pathway to a Better Life. Book signing and story presentation, these are all open to the public. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for sharing this with our listeners. We really appreciate you coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Author Stephen Worlin, Alan Bliss, and attorney Michael Fisher, all in studio. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion with our guests Lake Street Dive, Irish comic Maeve Higgins, Nashville's Margot Price, and yes, the one, the only Mr. Jack White. All this plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, that's Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, also my Song of the Week, and the First Call Radio Players will be there, and you'll just have to tune in.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Mill Street Radio. This week, I chat with Ari Shapiro of NPR's All Things Considered about fermented Swedish herring, eating meat pies at a performance of Sweeney Todd, and making a Wiener Schnitzel video with Yvonne Trapps. We also bring you a recipe for Japanese potato salad, and we investigate the link between taste and sound. Coming up this week on Mill Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's billed as an amazing adventure that will change your perspectives on aging and community. There's a big registration deadline coming up today as the YMCA and AARP join forces to present all ages one amazing adventure. What's this all about? Here with more, Justine Conley joins us. She's Jacksonville Field Coordinator with AARP. Hey, Justine.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to see you.
As always, it's good to see you as well.
So you're teaming up with the Y. What's happening? This sounds kind of interesting.
It is very interesting. AARP does all kinds of initiatives, and we have all kinds of national partnerships, collaborative partners. So AARP called and said they chose 10 cities to do some kind of pilot. You had to come up with a pilot. And so we had these interesting ideas, and we said, how about an amazing race? Let's get all kind of intergenerational age groups together to do a race that's not just physical agility, but also mental and fun.
This is a registration deadline, which is why you asked to come on the show today. Yes. You want to get people to sign up for this, but they have to sign up by today.
Well, we're extending the.
Oh, you are?
Yes, because Irma really threw us a loop, of course, and
yeah.
So we're having to scramble, but there's still time, and there's still time to register. And it is an what it's going to consist of is a team of six. You have to have 4 decades represented on your team of six.
So people like from 20s
nope.
to 60s.
We start at 30.
Okay, you start in the 30s.
Start in the 30s. 30s to 80 plus.
No millennials allowed?
We're not going to say it like that. We want them to have something to wait for and look forward to.
Oh, okay. So 30s to 80s.
Plus. And so I've been recruiting 80-year-olds as well to be on these teams.
So you get this multi-generational team, and they have to do a series of physical and mental challenges.
Yes, it will begin at Winston Y. It's going to be all downtown, and you go from clue to clue to clue.
So it's like a scavenger hunt?
Like a scavenger hunt, like an amazing race.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. And all ages. And again, AARP does a lot about disrupt aging. How do you push back against age-old stereotypes?
So you're trying to disrupt stereotypes and get people from different generations to work together and learn from each other. That's
pretty
neat.
To work together and learn from each other, exactly. Well
said. So what are some of the challenges that people on these teams are going to have?
They are under lock and key. We can't tell you that.
Oh, come on.
But there are prizes. In first place is a bicycle and helmet. Second place, wireless Beats. And third place, a gift certificate to...
Somewhere good.
Spa treatment.
Oh,
Thank you.
In now, Justine. Like, I am all about that. So you signed me up for this. Okay. So the deadline has been extended.
Yes.
But you do want people to, and people should challenge their coworkers to
challenge your
make
coworkers,
a team.
Your church, your temple, your family. You have all ages included. So challenge people and come join us. It is going to be on November 4th, beginning at 8 o'clock, and it's going to start at Winston Y and end at Winston Y. AARP's whole part of our tagline is help and empowering people 50 plus to choose how they live as they age. All of us are aging. And so how do we learn from each other about how to age well?
I love it. Register now for all ages. One amazing adventure.
Can I get a lot where they go to register? You go to mm-hmm. firstcoastymca.org/all-ages. firstcoastymca.org/all-ages. And I see that the people in the studio are like, oh, can sign us up. So yeah, come sign up with us.
Sign up and have fun. That sounds like, so you're going to see teams of people running through downtown Jacksonville
yes.
on this day in November.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Yes.
She's Justine Conley, Jack's field coordinator with AARP. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. Speaking
of aging well, that goes for homes as well as people. Finally, this hour, we've got a special treat for PBS fans and fans of Home Improvement. Kevin O'Connor, the host of the long-running and beloved PBS hit This Old House, is in town this weekend, and he's making some appearances at the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show. Now, Kevin has some amazing tips on how you can rehab an older home with all of their quirks and challenges. Kevin O'Connor, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This old house is so beloved, and so it's exciting to have you here in town. Because
thank you.
People just get so into home rehab and repair, particularly historic homes. What are you going to be talking about at the Home and Patio Show?
Well, we have a brand new season that's premiering on PBS in about 2 weeks. October 5th is our national premiere date, which means we have two new projects. We've got one in our backyard in Newton, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston, and then a second one down in Charleston, South Carolina, which has got some unbelievable architecture.
Oh, I know it.
It's absolutely fantastic. And so we're going to be doing the usual plan of rehabbing and saving these old homes. Throughout the season, however, we're going to be talking about a campaign that we call Generation Next. And the idea here is that there's a very large shortage of people going into the skilled trades. And there are literally somewhere between 3 and 5 million jobs that exist right now that are unfilled because young people have chosen not to go into the skilled trades.
Huh.
So we're going to highlight that problem. We're going to talk about some of the solutions. We've partnered with Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs.
I was just going to say, that's who I was thinking of in my head was Mike Rowe when you mentioned this.
Yeah, good for him because he's really done a better job than anyone we know of articulating this problem. Mm-hmm. But he's also set up a scholarship foundation. And so Thistle House, through our partners, has already donated $500,000 to that. And we're also bringing apprentices onto the job site. We're
Did you start as a skilled tradesman?
I didn't. And if you talk to anyone on the show, they'll know. They'll tell you that I'm not. They never miss an opportunity to say, hey.
They tell you, get in front of the camera and let us handle this. Okay.
They're like, I got a skills gap right here. Just call Kevin O'Connor. I actually grew up on the job site working with my dad and my brothers and stuff like that. But it was a side job for me. It was a passionate thing, but it's not where I went the college route. But there are great jobs out there and they're unfilled and they pay well. And it's one of the fastest ways to independent business ownership. So we're going to have apprentices with us on these jobs. We brought them from around the country. We're going to talk about the problem, talk about the solutions. And I think it's going to add a nice injection of excitement into the two projects that we're working on.
Now, of course, if you live in Springfield, Riverside, Avondale in particular, you're really interested in rehabbing an older home. What are some of the biggest challenges you find people face?
The biggest one that I think we come across is people don't understand the scope of what they're getting into. You know, old houses present a lot of different challenges. You can't see behind walls. So you think you're going to start with a kitchen renovation and you end up with a foundation rebuild.
Oh, right.
Or a roof repair. And that's just the way it goes. You know, these things, these houses have sort of deteriorated over years, sometimes over 100 years, and there are unknowns. And so it leads to sort of the advice we give people, which is find a good, reputable contractor who's familiar with this. And also stay flexible. You know, understand that the contractor may not have anticipated that the pipes behind the wall were decayed or clogged. And so you have to sort of have a mindset of there are going to be hiccups. There's going to be things that are unexpected. And you're going to have to deal with them and roll with them. And if you do that, oftentimes the payoff is worth it.
So make sure a good contractor looks at a home before you decide to buy it. And then if you do make that decision, where should you invest? Where do you get the biggest payoff?
Well, we will tell you that you get the biggest payoff with the systems you don't see. And most people don't like to hear that. But fixing the foundations, keeping the roof secure, and mostly upgrading the systems that provide comfort through the house, the heating, the air conditioning, the water supply, those types of things. A lot of folks want to start off and make a brand new kitchen because that's where they spend all of their time. And no one can blame them for that. But if you layer on $50,000 of renovation expense on a brand new kitchen, and underneath it, the systems aren't updated and they aren't working well, or the air conditioning isn't sufficient, or the house is drafty. To us, it is money not well spent. And so getting the house and its systems secured and fixed first before you do the sexy spaces, if you will, the kitchens and the bathrooms and stuff like that, we say start there.
What's the biggest mistake people make once they start down this path?
They underestimate the time it's going to take. There are so many unknowns. There are so many hiccups. They want it done fast. Someone tells them it'll take 3 months, and they say, okay, let's get it through done in 3 months, and it ends up taking 5, and that's just the way it goes, and it gets frustrating and expensive. Yeah. So you kind of plan for the worst and hope for the best.
You know, and in the wake of Hurricane Irma, there are a lot of people with historic homes that were flooded in this area, and so as awful as that is, there are people out there getting ready to undertake expensive renovation projects in their older homes. And so I know there's so much interest in your appearance. You are going to be at the Home and Patio Show today and tomorrow. And by the way, the show is donating 10% of ticket sales to the Clara White Mission as they are trying to assist even more people after Hurricane Irma. So if you buy a ticket to the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show this weekend, 10% of that cost will go to help victims of Hurricane Irma. Where can people see you today and tomorrow?
I'll be at the Prime Osborne, and I'm going to be on stage this evening at 6 p.m. and then tomorrow at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. And there'll be other people presenting and lots of vendors, and they'll be there on Sunday as well.
Very nice. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you in person. He's Kevin O'Connor, host of PBS's beloved program, This Old House. Go see him this weekend at the Prime Osborne. Go to the website jacksonvillehomeshows.com for more information. Have fun while you're here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app and catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. Up next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday. And right now, here's how you can support 89.9 FM.
Pick up your phone and give us a call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. See all the stars that come rolling through Jacksonville. Stop by First Coast Connect. In case you haven't noticed, there's been such a long list of people, TV, music, radio, movies, just some legendary performers have come through and stopped by to say hi to you, the listeners of First Coast Connect. I'm Kevin Mershart, producer of First Coast Connect, and I'm here to ask for your support for this station. This is our final day of our fall fun drive. Don't forget, we are going to give away one more Amazon Echo today, and then we're going to give away the best part, the big one, and that, of course, is the Echo Show. That has a little screen on it, so it does even more things than the Echo does. We're going to give one of those away at the end of the drive. Everybody who has called in and shown their participation are involved in the entry. But you got to get it done by 6 o'clock tonight. So why don't you just do it now before phones start really ringing off the hook later on this afternoon. Give us a call right now, and thank you very much if you already have. If you enjoy listening to the Media Roundtable, I know that a lot of people do. If you enjoy all the programs we bring you, if you enjoy all the stuff that comes to you every single day at WJCT, then please make that call right now. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528. Go online at wjct.org. This is your last chance to show your support for this for the program right now and the drive. So call right now. If you have, thank you very much. If you haven't, now's the time. What are you waiting for? 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528. And thank you very much for supporting this, your public radio station.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.